Welcome to Parents Perspective. One outing my children were always eager for was a trip with their dad to the grocery store. While I used to have them help push the cart and retrieve items from the shelves, their father took a more hands-on approach. "Okay, guys," he would direct, "each of you take a shopping cart and I'll meet you at the checkout counter in 20 minutes. I'm still amazed that the grocery store didn't roll out a red carpet when they saw him coming. There is no doubt that fathers are of vital importance in their children's lives. What constitutes good fathering? How do the differences in mothers' and fathers' parenting styles affect their children? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guests are both fathers who are involved professionally with parenting issues. Philip Cox heads the mentoring program for Dads, an organization which works with young fathers. He is also the father of a grown son and daughter, and he's a proud grandfather as well. Welcome, Philip.
Thank you for having me here.
Alan Coors is the director of the Episcopal Center for Children, a residential and day treatment center for emotionally troubled youngsters. He is the father of two grown children. We're glad to have you with us, Alan.
Thank you.
Could each of you begin by telling us about the organizations that we've just mentioned?
Alan, you want to start?
Sure. Well, the Episcopal Center for Children, where I'm working, and I've been there for a number of years, is a program, a treatment program for boys and girls who have been diagnosed as emotionally disturbed. The children are as young as 5, and they're as old as 10 and a half at time of admission, and the average stay is about 3 years once they get into the program. We don't really accept a child unless we also accept the family, because we feel that the families are a very important part of the treatment. So as a result, families agree to come into weekly therapy meetings for themselves, and of course each child is involved in a very therapeutically structured program during the week. Hopefully, within 2 or 3 or 4 years, the youngster is able to change and modify behaviors, and the family is, to the extent that they're able to return to a public school. And when the children return to public school, they generally return to a special education program, which is lesser in number than a regular mainstream classroom, to give the youngster a chance to practice his skills and get back online. And usually that works. The process is a long one. It doesn't take place overnight. It involves a great deal of cooperation from mothers and fathers. And I might add that the families that we serve tend to be single parents, either mothers or fathers, or grandparents, or guardians, or foster parents. So there's a wide constellation of the types of families that we serve. We don't only see the standard American family, if there is such one.
Philip, what about dads?
The DADS program is a component of the Mental Health Association in Montgomery County. It's a spinoff of a program called Young Fathers, Responsible Fathers that's done out of the Montgomery County Department of Health and Human Services. DADS tries to pair up a young father, basically between the age of 14 and 24, with an experienced dad over the age of 25. And the experienced dad pretty much is a coach. He's an advisor, and he's a motivator. He's someone that pushes the young father into employment, education, and responsibility, talking about sexual responsibility, financial responsibility, and emotional responsibility in relationship to their children.
Alan, what would you say are the traits most important for good fathering?
We've recently done a follow-up study for some of our children to see which children have done well. And a common thread among them has been that the children who have done best have had fathers who have been involved early on in the therapy. So I guess that leads to an answer to the question, which is essentially that fathers need to be involved. It's an important trait. They cannot be absentee fathers any more than we can have good absentee landlords. Fathers have to have hands-on approach. They need to be there. They need to be committed. They need to be available for their youngsters. They don't have to be outstanding, but showing up is certainly an important part of the process. So I think we need that sort of premise first.
I think there have been recent studies that say that children as young as 6 months are aware when their fathers enter the room that their heartbeat speeds up, their body language changes and everything. So it's clear.
I'm sure.
Philip, how is fathering different from mothering?
The concept is the same for both parents, except that just gender-wise, there are certain things that a father is able to transmit. In other words, if you have a father who is teaching a young child toilet training, there are certain things that a male can teach a young male. So that's a little difference there. Also in the nature of play, see, fathers from the, I won't say the moment of birth, but during the initial stage, they're kind of subservient to the mother role, because the mother is the nurturer. She provides the food. She does the diapers. She provides the warmth and so forth. And the father kind of recesses back a little bit and lets the mother assume and take control of that role. Now, later on, I would say probably about 2 or 3 years of age, the father goes through a period of what's called engrossment, where he becomes fascinated with the child's actions and movements, and he becomes more involved physically with the child, and the child responds to that physical relationship. So he continues that, and at that point is where we hope we have unity from both parents, where both the mother and the father are coming together to continue the raising of that child beyond that point. The male animal is a little more physical in his involvement with the child. And the children also need that. They also need to realize that the world is not totally dangerous out here, that you can grow and you can have a few tumbles and not necessarily, you know, end up with broken bones and so forth. So it's important to have a father directly involved in that developmental stage also.
Which brings us to our next question. Alan, could you give us some examples of traits fathers most often encourage in their children?
Well, unfortunately, some of the traits they encourage may not necessarily be the best. Every parent feels, I think, that they have some special quality that they would like to expose their child to. They're the best this or the best that. But I think a mature father tries to dampen that somewhat and let the child have some sense of autonomy so that he can develop on his own. There was an old Native American proverb that used to say, we give two things to our children. One is roots and one is wings. And essentially what we're trying to do with a father is to have him orchestrate that dance between individuation and connectedness with the family. How do you make that bridge between the two? And the best way is moderation, I think.
Alan, how do fathers influence a child's problem-solving skills?
Again, with the way they model for the children, fathers and mothers, when there is a father and a mother, are constantly working with conflicts, decision-making, problems that occur around the house. Connecting and providing for a child and giving that child freedom is something that constantly brings forth discussion between a mother and a father. You know, should he do this? Shouldn't he do that? Oh, let the boy be a boy. Let the girl be a girl. These sorts of things. How the father models those problems, how he models his frustrations, how he deals with it is a very powerful message for the son and for the daughter, because at some point or another, there is some vestige, I think, of traditional fatherhood in the media or in the family that suggests that the father's role is an important one. And when he models it with a violent outburst and breaking a chair or throwing down a glass or throwing the burnt steak out the window, that's probably not a very good message for the youngster. If we see a different way of responding, then I think we're going to see different children becoming different adults.
Philip, what do you see as the effects on a child of little or no fathering?
Let me give you maybe a situation and set it up for you. Let's say we have a young man who is growing up in a single-parent home with his mother. Basically, she sets the example. What he sees is basically a female perspective of virtually every factor of life of growing up, as far as the things that he watches on television, his hygiene, his health. All those things are given to him from that female perspective. And sometimes he has a tough time in school in addressing issues. When they have someone that can set an example for them, then they have some foundation upon which to go out into society and say, okay, my actions are not going to be misinterpreted because they've had that exposure and they know what societal norms are, or they, at least they have exposure to those societal norms in some form. So it's really important emotionally for a young man to have a male or a father involved in his life, someone to talk to from that male perspective. Also, a lot of times the father is some sort of financial provider for him. And it's important to a child. It doesn't make any difference what sex you are. If you know that your father is making a contribution towards your development, whether it's food or whether it's money or whether it's transportation or if it's spending time, that means something emotionally and mentally for young people. So it's important to have a father involved.
I might just to add on to that, I think it's very important to note that it doesn't have to be the biological father. And we certainly see many situations where youngsters have, in fact, grandparents or grandfathers serving in that father's role, or neighbors, or church leaders, or uncles, or other male models. And they really can do quite well as fathers. The important thing doesn't seem to be the child's acceptance of them, because the child accepts just that he has an older grandfather serving in that role. It's not really his problem. It's, I think, frequently the problem of the other adults who think, well, he can't be the father because he's a grandfather, he's too old. And in fact, that really doesn't make any difference. If we have a good image there as the male model for that youngster, it works.
Philip, what skills do fathers need to effect a good partnership with mothers? Even if there's been a divorce, there still has to be a relationship.
The key there is communications. You have to talk. Even in a divorce situation, it's important that both parties communicate so that they set a unified standard for their children. It's not appropriate to have mother setting a time limit of 10 o'clock, and then when the child is visiting with the father, he sets a 12 o'clock. That's playing one side against the other. And they need to mediate those type of concerns when they're talking about what should we buy him or what should we provide for him and what should we give him and what are the limitations. They should sit down and have a communication and, if necessary, go to mediation and say, okay, we're concerned about the child. That's the most important part of this whole process.
You would emphasize that same skill if you've got two parents living in the same household, I'm sure.
Yes. Hopefully that's what occurs in most households.
Alan, could you give some examples of the differences between a daughter's and a son's relationship with a father? We sort of touched on that a little bit ago, but maybe we could get a little deeper into it.
Well, I may have to get into a little speculation, having had two sons, not having had a daughter, although always wishing that I would have had one. I think there is a real difference, obviously, between a relationship between the father and the son and the father and the daughter. I think the father and the daughter becomes a protector sort of a relationship, a guider relationship, where the father looks out for and takes a very different role than he does with the son. My sense of it, a father's relationship with a son is an enabler, helping that youngster join in, get on board, make his way as an adult, and try to make a success of whatever he's doing. But I see fathers, and again, I'm speaking as a father who does not have a daughter. My expectation of a good father with a daughter is one who helps that process take forth or go forth with another person.
Do you see differences among the children that you're dealing with in the Episcopal Center for Children in their relationships with their fathers?
Yes. The youngsters that we have at the center, when girls see their fathers coming into therapy, they tend to want to tell them about the program. They want to tell them about what it's like, all the little pieces that go on in their daily lives. Boys, when they run to their fathers, when they do come in for therapy sessions, generally want to tell them about what they've done, what they've accomplished, what skills they've come up with. They can swim, they can play basketball, they can do this. Accomplishments become more important, seemingly, for the boy to tell the father. And for the girls, they want to tell them about the workings of the establishment, the process, what's going on, who's who, and what relationships are existing. So there's clearly, at an early age, a difference in terms of interest. I don't think that's sexist. I think it's a response to reality.
Alan, what do you see as the differences between fathering today and fathering a generation ago?
Well, they're significant, and there's a variety of reasons for it. And, of course, as we go back more than one generation, two generations, three generations, historically we see a great number of differences. Clearly, the fathers of 25, 50, 70 years ago seem to be much more hands-on in terms of their jobs. Children knew what their fathers did. They were easy to identify with. If you were a farmer or you worked with your hands, you knew what your dad did. Increasingly, of course, we've become a service economy, and parents come home and children will ask dad, what did you do today? And if you're processing mortgages or something of this sort, applications, it's pretty hard to pass that on to a youngster in any meaningful way. So I think the work experience is different for parents and what they can offer children in terms of a work experience that is somehow translatable to the child's world is very different. I think also there's a difference in terms of the stress that fathers are under. And I say the stress because I think our lives have become increasingly busy. And I think invariably parents don't feel in charge of their lives. I think they feel that they are subject to others' whims, others' pressures, the IRS, the government, the doctor's appointments, the mechanic who's working on their car. Everybody seems to have a piece of their lives, and that invariably has to spell out in stress and frustration that the father is going to have to moderate before he exhibits it to the child. So I think the difference is stress. I think the difference is time. And I think the difference is being able to identify with your work. I think those are real differences for fathers today.
May I add a little something to what Alan's saying? Oh, not saying that I'm that old, but I know back in the 40s and 50s, as a young child, plenty of times we would go to the store during the week, but come the weekend, everything was closed, and part of that was religion. It was on Sundays, everything was shut down, and you went to church, and you spent majority of your day there in church. And on Saturday, you went to church, and you rehearsed, and you know, if you sung in a choir, you did certain things. And I think in today's society, a lot of that has gotten moderated. Services are shorter. The activities that occur at the church aren't as significant as they used to be in the past. I think as society has moved forward, from the 50s into the 90s, we've lost a little of our belief in our spiritual importance that we have as far as what we give to our families and what we share with our families. So we've lost something as we move forward into this generation.
I think a lot of people share that feeling.
Yeah, and I think also that there's an important piece here with the family. We're talking about fathers, but they exist in a context. And I think there's an article that really bears on what we're talking about. And it was a number of years ago in a magazine called The Academic, and it was called The Disturbing Changes in the American Family by Yuri Bronfenbrenner. And he had a very interesting thesis, and I think what he studied came as a result of looking at census tract data. So it was a wide variety of studies. This was not just one study, but a whole number of studies that were subsumed in this larger study. And he felt that there were two changes in the American family. One was that the number of significant adults in the family available to the child. The second one was the amount of actual sincere involvement in terms of time with the child. And everything that he was able to show from the fact that in the 1900s, nearly every family had a third or a fourth adult, an Aunt Sally or a grandmother living in that home. We have become increasingly nuclear and then even less so. And the second part of it, of course, is that when parents are home, they're spending less and less time because of what we're talking about right here with their children. And the amount of time in some families is really infinitesimal in seconds or minutes in terms of sincere. And I'm not talking about a father watching a TV show or a football show or reading a paper with the child sitting over in the other corner. That's not meaningful involvement, but actual meaningful involvement where you're interacting. So I think that's very important. Surprisingly, what he says is changing these two areas has been replaced by three items, and I think this is quite interesting too. He said what has replaced parents and caring adults has been TV, loneliness, and peers. And essentially, that really, when we think about it, has what has taken the excess time that children have not found with their families and with individual members of that family. Children become latchkey children. People watch a lot of TV. We know that. And I think children spend an awful lot of time just being lonely.
If I can add to that, part of it currently is the Internet that's beginning to sprout out a lot.
Pulling more people away.
Right. Kids are able to go on the Internet and access all types of different types of information. And they're more interested in what they can see than being directly involved with some of the other kids. They're actually losing contact with their peers to go to these mediums. So we're going to have to be careful about that in the next few years. If you set limitations, if you say these are the conditions of the household, these are the standards that we're going to set here within our household, that we're going to have X number of hours as far as viewing television. If you want to do something on a computer other than homework, you have X number of hours to do it on that. If you want to play in sports, then okay, we'll take you and bring you back and do those kind of things. But you have to set limitations, and it becomes more important now for us to do that.
Well, we wish that we had more time together, all four of us, because there's an awful lot we didn't get to. But we are very grateful to our guests, Philip Cox and Alan Kors, for their insights and perspectives on fathering. Thank you both for your comments.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Our pleasure. A new feature on Parents' Perspective will be listeners' polls. Please call our toll-free number, 1-800-791-8573. That's 1-800-791-8573. And give us your response to the following three questions. In your household, what is your biggest worry? What are the ages of your children? And of the Parents' Perspective shows you have heard, which show did you find most helpful? Again, our toll-free number is 1-800-791-8573. If you'd prefer, you need not leave your name or phone number, but we're eager to hear from you. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective.
Are there topics you would like to hear about on this program? Do you have tips for other parents? If you have comments, questions, or suggestions for Parents' Perspective, you can call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573. 1-800-791-8573. Or email us at parentspur@aol.com or contact us, care of this station. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.